great audio, and you just download the computer and then...
Okay, Kim Campbell, former Prime Minister of Canada, and many other things which I have on her resume, including being inducted into the International Women's Forum's Hall of Fame last night. So your response to my point about one of the great things about you being that you are a woman, I believe, who lifts other women.
I certainly try to, and it's an important part of my my working life to do things that with causes that advance women. But I think I wasn't always that way. Certainly when I was very young, I didn't have a lot of female role models, and like many people, I exempted myself from the stereotypes, but I don't know how much solidarity I had. And I think part of it is, well, first of all, you just mature, and you get over your own hubris and you realize there are a lot of other smart girls out there. But I think also, as we begin to make progress, it makes it possible for us to pursue our own dreams without feeling it's a zero-sum game with other women. I mean, one of the things about tokenism is that tokenism breeds that kind of competition and lack of support. Because if you know there's only room for one woman in a position, or a law firm's only going to make one woman a partner, that there are limited opportunities, and every other woman is your competitor. And that's a terrible way to live. I mean, I think, you know, men are very competitive, and certainly there are lots of situations where they're competitive. But I think when you have a category, which means that the competition is very narrow. I mean, if you're a man and you're in a law firm, for example, all the partners, you know, you feel you have access to any of the partner slots. You're not going to be... You're not going to be excluded if somebody else like you gets chosen, that there's room for more than one. And I think this is the case with any kind of group that is a minority in a situation. And so I think, I mean, I've mellowed a lot as I've gotten older, and also came to understand that my ability to speak in my own voice depended on having other people like me around the table, that I could be much more who I am if it was accepted that people like me sat at the table, as opposed to being there on suffrage, or sufferance rather, or because I thought like a man or wasn't like other women. And there was a woman in my province, Grace McCarthy, who had, she's a full generation older than I am, 20 odd years older than I am, who had started a career in public life in the local parks board. She was actually very good, and then she ran provincially, and she was a minister in the provincial government when I was a backbencher on the government side. And she had kind of an eccentric way of dressing, sort of fairly feminine, but very kind of, you know, flouncy and whatever. And I never could quite relate to her. She wasn't, she was a businesswoman. She'd started a chain of flower shops that had been very, very successful. She was a florist and done very well as a small businesswoman and made a lot of money. And I never could quite relate to her. But I feel now, when I ran into her in Vancouver a year or so ago, and she looked terrific. But I feel a much greater appreciation for her, because she really did have to kind of define her own way. And she was a woman who was very smart. She was also feminine. She was tough. She was all sorts of things. And I find now, as I'm older, I just have great deal more tolerance for the myriad ways that people express their personalities, and you know, they don't all have to be like me. It doesn't mean that I support all women. Some women, you know, if they don't have character, I mean, I do not forgive women things that I don't forgive other people. But anyway, I just
you have put those things so beautifully, and a number of things. I love what you said. You captured it so well about that piece about why women compete with one another the way they do. So thank you. That's a powerful piece. I am sure from reading your book, from who you are and all that, that you agree with me, which is one of the pieces of this book, that women's achievement, individual achievement, isn't enough. That that women's leadership, in terms of having power and having influence and having lots of seats at the table, is important. Do you agree with that? And if so, why?
Well, I agree with it, again, because it makes the difference between being seen as, in inverted commas, a woman and just being a person at the table. And when we know there's all this research about critical mass, and some people say 30%, if you have 30% women, then you have a change in the agenda. You can even have fewer. I mean, it's been seen that even one woman on a bench can make a difference. But it's this notion of being able to speak in your own voice and be who you are and not have the situation where people assume that all women are going to agree with one another. Lots of women in my life I can, you know, knock down, drag out. I think Sarah Palin is an abomination.
Thank you.
And I don't care what her reproductive system is. And I think you put it extremely well on your website.
Thank
and it
you.
Was a great relief to me to see that somebody could articulate it so well. So I think that it is that, you know, belonging there, not just having met somebody else's standard, but having it understood that there are lots more like you who are competent and able, and that women bring their own qualities to these positions as well. They don't necessarily just do them like men.
But it's also that piece that I believe this book is, as I told you, is about American women, but there's a chapter on the perspective from global women, that we are a nation in the United States right now of female achievers, and you and I lived the 40 years where we were coming out of the universities in the early 70s, you know, late 60s, and then trying to achieve economic independence. Done.
Yeah.
That the next stepping stone is reaching higher, I mean, for actual power and leadership.
First of all, I always say to women, look, power exists, and somebody is going to have it. Why not you, if you think you would exercise it ethically? You know, don't sort of disdain. A lot of them say, oh, I don't want to have power. I love power. Give me power. I want it. I am power hungry, because when I have power, I can accomplish things. I can help open doors for other people, not just women, but deserving people. I can make things happen. I can serve my community. I can influence decisions. So I'm not the least bit disdainful of power. But one of the things I might say in terms of the difference, say, between my own country and the United States, and we're such close neighbors and we
yes.
are able to communicate so well, I think American political culture is quite macho, oddly enough.
More than Canada.
I think more than Canada, and oddly enough, more than
in other parts of the world.
Well, European, it's not so great in some places. It depends on how you see it. Although, again, you know, for example, in France, there is a woman of color who is a justice minister now. She's 42, and she's pregnant. She's not indicating who the father is, and she's going to have a child. She wants to have a child. Well, I mean, this would not happen in the United States. I mean, this would be considered really off the wall.
She doesn't resign.
And in France, people, you know, ho-hum. You know, I mean, it's just, people don't really think about it. I mean, it's not that it doesn't make news, but people say, isn't this interesting that she has, you know, obviously she doesn't have a spouse, and she wants to have a child, and she's 42 and doesn't want to wait any longer, and
yeah.
there you go. But
yeah.
that doesn't affect her qualities of serving.
Yeah, it's not, isn't this horrible, but isn't this interesting?
But I think in the United States it derives from a number of things. One, for example, your head of state is the commander-in-chief. And you're a big, powerful military country. And so there is always this underlying agenda, can, you know, a woman be commander-in-chief? I mean, is this... And then the odd thing is, I mean, I served as defense minister of my country. And the commander-in-chief is in theory a little different. I should give orders to the military. But being able to do that as a politician, as somebody who's not been in the military, involves not just understanding how the military operates. Macho qualities are really dangerous in those circumstances. You're putting people's lives in danger, and you have to understand the strategic use of military power and be very clear about when it serves your national interest to do that. And I think with men, often, and particularly men who've not served in the military, and we're seeing generations of this now in the United States leadership, the men who don't have the World War II background as many of the leaders had after World War II, people who'd had their military service. Or who had at least, you know, been in the army.
There.
I mean, Harry Truman was had a distinguished career in World War I. That there is this almost, I don't know if I call it epaulette envy or something, how to describe it, this need to show their masculinity by, look how tough I am. And that there's some kind of expectation. And I think
that's in our culture. And I have a chapter about how American culture undermines women's leadership.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about what you've observed about
that.
Well,
I just think that is the case. Leadership is gendered masculine in most countries. But it's interesting in the United States that, unlike many other countries, I mean, I don't see it in Britain at all. I don't see it in Canada. There is this kind of sense of also there's a kind of sense of exceptionalism that America is different and that leaders have to be kind of tough. And you, and maybe because the American leader, the American president, wields this extraordinary power.
Military power is what we're talking about by virtue of
the size and power of your country. But I think that can often work against women. But I will say this, that I thought Hillary Clinton was very remarkable in the Democratic primary campaign.
Yeah.
It must be a deep disappointment to her. She lost a campaign that she should have won.
Yes.
And she ran a bad campaign, and Barack Obama simply ran a very intelligent, flawless campaign. Yes. And he's a great candidate. I mean, I don't take anything away from him. And much of what we're saying about gender applies mutatis mutandis, as they say, to him.
What does that mean?
That means sort of the same thing, only changed for the specifics of a different case, but the same kind of idea. That it applies to what he faces in terms of race. Again,
yes.
The same sense, does he belong there?
Yes, changing the template.
Changing the template, very much so. And being more than just a token, but, you know, and the fear that people have, you know, like Margaret Thatcher. I think if Margaret Thatcher had been seen as the thin edge of a wedge of women coming into the political hierarchy, she would have had a much harder time. And the fact that she didn't have that solidarity with women, although when she was younger she was very adamant that women had a right to have careers, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But I think just given the party that she was in and the generation, the time, you know, she couldn't be. I mean, and again, she was also like I was when I was younger. I mean, she felt that she had accomplished things through her own qualities, and that, you know, if she made it, other people could make it. Well, it isn't really that simple.
Yeah.
And that's why we do have to reach out to
yes.
other women. And she always said, well, she just appointed people on merit, but you've got to reach out and cultivate
yes.
know, the people who can take these jobs.
I'm watching your time, and so I want to ask you one last really important question, and this is really asking you to look at American women mm-hmm. and whatever you want to say to American women, but a piece of it is the where do you see American women right now, and is there an opportunity perhaps for American women that we underestimate because we do look inward so much to really step up and help women throughout the world not only by our modeling of reaching higher, but also being conscious of our role in the world?
Well, I actually, I mean, I think, first of all, there are all sorts of wonderful American women who are doing great things. And it's interesting, it's frustrating that the numbers, for example, in the national government, are low compared
yeah.
to other countries in the world.
Yeah.
And yet you do have some women playing important roles. I think of the women who are in the U.S. Senate. I mean, both California's senators are women.
Yeah.
I think of somebody like Kay Bailey Hutchison, et cetera. And it's funny because you know, the women who do get elected, you know, do very, very well. Liddy Dole is having a struggle for her
yeah.
her Senate seat, but her contender is a woman, so it's not that's a difficulty for her. But I do think, I mean, I still think that there are barriers, and I'm not sure what they all are, for getting women in there. One of them would be financial. I mean, it is so expensive to run for American office now,
yeah.
particularly at the national level, and very, very difficult. And I think women are not always as comfortable asking for money.
And women don't give it as generously.
They don't give it. They don't write it. I mean, people often say, how do we get more women in office? And I say, write a check. And many
yeah.
women won't give them. I don't understand. What is very fascinating to me is how little it takes to be a player. That if more women got involved in their local party organization, whichever party they favor, and gave them $10,000 a year. Now, $10,000 is a lot of money, but for a successful businesswoman, it isn't necessarily. Now, in Canada, these contributions up to not very big are tax deductible. I don't know if they're tax deductible here, but even mm-hmm. so, $10,000, even $5,000, but I think $10,000. Maybe that's more than you can give now to a party organization. I have to go back.
I think it is. Individually, yeah. it's $2,500.
Yeah, but even if you, you know, keep doing it, you become a player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really, it doesn't take, I mean, I was amazed at all the scandals, and, you know, and Enron and all these people who were supposedly big hoo-has with George Bush's campaigns. That, to me, the numbers, in terms of the money that they raised, didn't seem all that high. I mean, $100,000. It's a lot of money, but it's not for those people with the kind of wealth they had.
Yeah.
Wasn't an enormous amount of money. And I think women don't understand how they can parlay their economic success into political leverage. And in the back rooms, and it's interesting, Nancy Pelosi built her base in the Democratic Party as a fundraiser.
Yeah.
You know, she was raising her kids. She's interesting. And a lot of people, you know, tried to say, well, she's just an airhead and whatever, because, you know, it was hard for them to see her moving from being, you know, the
right.
nice
Because we part. Don't value women's experience.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but also that you know, we've sort of slaughtered her, that she was somebody who went out and raised money and was saying, how do you do? And now, my goodness, she actually wants to be in Congress. So I think that women need to learn that. But it's interesting, because a country like Sweden, where by virtue of their laws, they have about half women in their government. But women are virtually absent from corporate power there.
Oh.
So I think when we look at women's power, we have to step back and look in a variety of sectors.
Mm-hmm.
There is also the phenomenon that whenever a sector becomes dominated by women, it often loses power and status.
Yes.
A medical profession, even the legal profession, growing numbers of women are part of that profession. You know, does it lose its ability to, you know, be the
power brokers,
the
money? Yeah. I mean, the salaries start going down.
So it's an interesting phenomenon, although I suppose if it all sort of works towards the mean and creates greater equality, that wouldn't necessarily.
Yeah.
As a Canadian, that's not a bad thing. Maybe Americans would agree with that. But I would just say that
message
that,
to that, American women, yeah.
But I do think that American women are doing a lot of things. I mean, America is a very complex country. It is many countries. And in the same way that you elected a president who said, piffle to the Geneva Conventions, piffle to the Nonproliferation Treaty, hoo-ha, why do I have to pay attention to all this architecture of annoying treaties that might get in my way? The fact of the matter is that much of that architecture of international agreements was created through American leadership. So on the one hand, you have ditzballs who don't get it, and on the other hand, you have visionary people who have used American power and all of the dynamism and energy that comes from this society to do wonderful things in the world. And there are American organizations, you know, working to advance the role of women. There are, you know, the problem when your government, you know, for example, in the World Population Organization or the instruments of the UN, you know, will not support international organizations that even, you know, contemplate abortion or
right.
whatever, or that they're not even too keen on birth control, which
right.
really drives me crazy. And we should all run and read Canadian novelist Margaret Atwood's book, The Handmaid's Tale, if you want to
okay.
sort of think about
okay.
contemplate
Thank you, I will.
What it means to live in a society where you don't have control over your fertility. But, you know, I do think that there is a sense among a lot of American women and a lot of support, there is a lot of support by these women and organizations around the world to advance women. And I don't think that as an American you should feel abashed or inadequate, whatever. But the point is that your country is very complex. And just as you have some people who are supporting these organizations, raising money for them, helping them and doing things around the world, you have others who are pursuing a different agenda.
Yes.
But I think what I would just conclude with is that in my lifetime, I have watched a remarkable change in American politics, that the voices of the religious right and very fundamentalist views have become more mainstream in a way that I wouldn't have in a million years anticipated when I was a young university-age woman in the 1960s. And it worries me because what it carries with it are a number of things. First of all, very traditional and unwelcoming views about women.
Yeah.
Their ability to control their bodies, their right to be places. Now, it's interesting. These are the same people who think Sarah Palin is the second coming. But it's interesting because she does not in any way challenge any of those stereotypes. And, you know, very often people from outside get a special pass if the very fact, you know, the very fact that a woman is saying these things, for many people, this is a, you know, thumbing the nose at a Hillary Clinton type of person.
Yes.
You know, well, so, you know, we don't have to pay attention to Hillary Clinton because Sarah Palin's a woman and she doesn't support all of these things. But not only is it very dangerous for women, but it's the whole anti-science, disdain of rationality, magical thinking approach which is profoundly, profoundly dangerous in my view. And again, the American economy was built on innovation. Science, the growth and the dynamism of American science is the foundation of the world's largest economy. And yet we have people who, you know, with, if the scientific conclusions are not congenial, forget it. Sarah Palin is an interesting example. She had received a report by a scientist in Alaska about the implications of global warming for the survival of the polar bear. And it raised serious concerns. She took the report and she lied about it. She said, oh, the scientists didn't discover any problem. And a journalist went through great difficulties to get access to this. He was told if when he applied through Access to Information in Alaska, it would cost almost $500,000 to get it, which is bananas. Yeah. And we see this now that they're
yeah, there's $15 million to get their text messages,
just
right?
Ridiculous. But he went through a federal government avenue and was able to get it. And the report said exactly the opposite.
What she said?
Yeah, which to me suggests, I mean, a mendacity that is mind-boggling in terms of, I mean, if you don't like the result, you can at least say, well, I don't like the methodology, or we're going to get some other studies, or I'm unpersuaded by it, or something. But not lying about what its conclusions were. I mean, that's to me, I don't care what your sex is.
Right.
A liar is a liar, and you don't belong in public life. But it is also this underlying view that there is a deeper truth. You know, when George Bush, you know, looked into Putin's eyes, and instead of, I'm a former Soviet specialist, and instead of seeing, you know,
KGB.
A former KGB agent, you know,
saw his soul.
Well, you know, good for you, George. You're the only one I ever saw it. So, but I mean, it is this reliance on now gut instinct is not a useless thing, and in fact, what often our gut instinct is simply a reflex based on all of the
Experiences
that we've had. But if we have a highly uninformed gut instinct, if our experiences are minimal and our curiosity is zero, then relying on our gut instinct is a pretty dangerous thing. And perhaps one of the advices one should give young people is inform your gut. Get out there, see the world, experience things outside your own reality,
yes.
So that the reflexes and instincts that you develop about the world are based on some understanding of realities. Howard Gardner, who writes about leadership, the Harvard professor, he says great leaders travel. And he doesn't mean just that they get a passport, get out of their own country, but that they get out of their own reality.
Mm.
And, you know, so that they see a world that's broader. But what I'm very concerned about is this, the respectability given to people whose views are based, as I say, quote, on just religious faith of whatever sort, although I never could figure out. George Bush said that Jesus was, you know, the political philosopher. But Jesus, when he was asked which political philosopher most influenced him, he said Jesus. And I thought, you know, Jesus was a great teacher, and I'm kind of curious to know what George's Bible study group talked about when they contemplated Jesus' very powerful and an insightful comment that it was easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get into heaven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm not particularly religious, but I'm well educated religiously, and I think, like all great religious leaders, Jesus was a wonderful teacher, and the one he could capture profound ethical insights in clear and simple language, and he could tell the story. And to me, I mean, I don't see how any of this stuff has ever had any effect whatsoever on George W. Bush's approach to politics. So you can, you know, talk a good game, but what you do has absolutely nothing to do with the ethic, which is actually a very demanding one. So, but I am concerned about it, and I think women are very vulnerable to this for this kind of thinking. I think that the way it plays out is not only dangerous to society in a whole variety of ways, you know, as I say, in terms of it being the ability to use our intellectual products to make the world better, but that women become the casualties in this kind of traditional anti-rational thinking, and it concerns me very, very much that this has now entered the mainstream of American politics and is actually seen as respectable, and that a man like John McCain would play to that base in running, you know, would want so much to be president that he would contribute to that.
Even though it was not his base, but he was ready to it and activate it.
And when at one time in his life he was prepared to identify the intolerance that came out of that sector and now appears not to. So that worries me.
Anything, one last 30-second wrap it up, and they're waiting for you downstairs.
Just that you know, the world is full of wonderful women. I do a lot of work in Africa, and women are going to be the future of that continent when they can get, well, in some countries they're doing very well, South Africa, Rwanda, for instance, they're almost half of the parliament, and that isn't the end of the story. I mean, they still really have to be accepted, and very often in countries that are very tribal in their approaches to leadership, this often excludes women, and we see this in many, many societies in the world. But it is, to me, it's no accident that the World Values Survey finds a strong correlation between the presence of modern values in a society, you know, appreciation for learning, appreciation for liberty, et cetera, and the status of women. And to me, we are the canaries in the mine. We're half the population, so, you know, there's a lot of canaries in this mine. But where women are at any given time and what opportunities are open to them and how free they are to speak in their own voices and to control their own lives.
And how high they reach.
And how they reach is a powerful indication of the fundamental values and structures of a society. And so when we work for the advancement of women, as women, we do it for ourselves and people like ourselves. But it isn't a purely selfish enterprise. It really does have an impact on society as a whole. And as my friend Getumile Maziri, the former president of Botswana, would say, he and I were together on a mission to Sierra Leone to encourage the participation of women in politics. And he said, if you're not including your women, you're walking on one leg. And that's true for human society.
Kim Campbell, thank you so much. This has been fantastic to talk to you.